Okay, we're going to go ahead and start our class this morning. I know with the holiday weekend, we may have some of our members away. So we're going to go ahead and start. Our lesson is going to be today is on Revelation 17. We have looked at some beasts and dragons and other horrifying creatures in the last few weeks. And so we're going to see a new one today. We're going to do a quicker review of the beasts and dragons we've seen in the last few chapters. Then we're going to meet a new beast today, the Scarlet Beast. So we'll take a look at what that is all about. A different twist of things with the Scarlet Beast that we're going to see today. So we're going to see actually the Scarlet Beast is actually a partnership between this woman who is riding him in on him and then the bright red beast that she is riding on. So that's what we're going to take a look at today. Perry's going to go ahead and lead us in a time of prayer.
Dear great God, we thank you again to be together today as your children. We thank you for the love you've shown us, the life you've given us, the hope you've provided through Jesus. God, we ask that you be with the class this morning, help us to understand your message, help Mark to communicate his thoughts clearly. We thank you so much for the blessing of the church and to be together for opportunities like this to
Okay, very good. So backing up just a bit, we're going to take a look at some of the things that we have seen in the last couple of weeks, just to get it fresh in your mind, because it's important to have an overall idea of what we're doing. So you can look at the menu. Look at the specials menu today. Yeah, that's right. Good. We saw the dragon back in chapter 12. This is a softball question to the day. Who's the dragon?
The devil.
The devil, Satan, the accuser. He comes and he assaults the people of God. So specifically, he assaulted most of all in that metaphor. Who is he most trying to kill? Well, there was one particular person he was trying to kill.
Jesus.
The woman and her child. Her child who was born. And did the dragon kill him or not?
No.
I threw the nice soft fastball down and then it caught you with a change up there. Did the dragon kill the child? Yes, he did. He killed him on the cross, right? He killed him on the cross. He did kill him. But what did he do? Raised from the dead. God took him up to his side. So the dragon did succeed in killing this child, this special child. The dragon did get his way. But what did it lead to?
His
own downfall. That's what the thing is. The dragon's hatred and fury and anger, it compelled him to do something that would destroy him. So he self-destructed by killing Jesus. And it's kind of an important thing to remember about the dragon's hatred, because we sometimes look at the dragon as he can really destroy us, but he really can't destroy us unless we let him. Because if he kills us, that's a good thing for us. And that's the thing to worry about him. Okay, good, John.
He had help too. Jesus allowed him to do it.
Yeah, that's the point, right? That's the point, is the dragon's hatred and anger was actually unleashed. God didn't stop him. God could have protected his son, but he didn't. He let him destroy him. Now, you can be destroyed in your body. The dragon could crush your body. He can take away everything you have in this world. He can ruin your life, but he can't take your heart away from God. Can't take your soul away from God. Go ahead. That's kind of true, isn't it? That's interesting. Now, the one thing that we notice about this dragon, the people he was chasing around, he was really trying to hurt them. He was really going to try to pull them away from God. But God protected them somehow. This woman who represents God's people, he put her someplace where she could be absolutely safe from the dragon. Not her body, but her spirit and her heart. Where did the dragon couldn't find her?
In
in the desert, the wilderness, because in the wilderness, what does that mean? It means a word. Eight letters, start with H, ends with Y.
Humility.
Humility. So while you're on here on this earth, that's what will guard your heart. As long as you have a humble heart, the devil can't take your heart away from God. He can beat you up, he can take your goods away, he can hurt people, he can crush your life, but he can't take your heart away from God as long as you're cloaked in humility. That's what a wilderness is. The wilderness and the desert. That's where he protects her. So that's the thing to remember. Protect from the dragon. Always remember, it's to keep a humble heart. So the next beast that we see, the next chapter, we see the beast comes out of the sea. This dragon is looking over the sea. He has a foot on the shore of the sea, and he's looking out to see what's going to come out of it. He's kind of conjuring up some awful beast. The first beast comes out of the sea, and you can peek at chapter 13 if you want to. What does this beast look like when he first comes out of the water? That's very good. Okay, that's good quality right there. What does this beast of the sea, what does he look like? There's all these heads, all these horns. He has parts of something else too. Leopard and a bear and a lion. He's got these parts of all these creatures. So he has all these things that represent from the book of Daniel. They remind us of something.
Government.
The great empires of the world. In other words, in this beast out of the sea, he incorporates and encapsulates all of the great powers of the world. And we talked about what he does is he comes out on the earth, and what does he try to exert on people? Force. His will. His power. May be literal violence, could be war, but it really just means he's trying to exert his will on people. He wants to force people to do what he wants them to do. He has this urge to dominate. And that's what the beast out of the sea is. It's self-will, human will. And this is the beast that is worshipped as kind of a proxy for worshipping what else? The dragon. Worshipping of the dragon. But down at the root of the heart of worshipping this beast, who are we really worshipping? Yourself. The worship of self. That's what it... Worship of self, all the false idols that he gives us, all the horrible things that he wants us to worship and follow and obey, those are all false forms of worshipping self. And it's very clear on the surface when you see this awful beast with all these horns and heads and parts of leopards and everything like that. Would you want to worship a thing like that? No. So if it looks that bad, if the force of human will, when we said when we realize that we're worshiping ourselves with our idols, it looks bad, doesn't it? Looks horrible. It looks even bad to call it that you're worshiping yourself. No one wants to admit that, even though all the false idols they create really are worship of self. So how do we fall into that anyway? If we know it's so ugly and hideous, why do you do that? Someone else comes along.
Provides us security, we'll worship it. If it helps us keep what we want and helps us do what we want, we will worship it.
And that's what happens, because there's another beast that comes along to help us to do that.
False religion.
The second beast.
The second beast, the beast out of the earth. He's called the false prophet. What does this second beast look like? Looks like this cute little lamb coming along and tell us how to live a good life and have good things and God love you and it'll be great.
Innocent looking.
Innocent looking. But then when he's... when he has his stubby little horns, not real horns. Some stubby ham, lamb horns.
Cute little horns.
Cute little lamb horns. They couldn't do anything. Look, I can't do anything. He's talking about God. He's talking about God wants me to be happy, right? God wants me to have all kind of things, doesn't he? That sounds like little tiny little lamb horns. Oh, it's not going to do any damage. Well, what does this guy do? He performs some miracles. This guy is awing everybody because this lamb, he performs miracles. What kind of miracles does he perform? What does he do to people? What does he talk you into? He talks you into believing that he's speaking for God. When he holds out these things that you're allowed to do, he rationalizes it in a way that, hey, God wants you to do this. You're serving God. He might sound peaceful and delicate. He said, God wants you to go around grabbing all the goodies you can have out down here, right? God likes you, right? Or when he shows you someone over there that is being disobedient to God, what does he tell you about him?
He's bad. He's bad.
So what are you allowed to do to that person? You're allowed to hurt him, to judge him, to hate them, you anger them. You're allowed to harm them because he's a bad person. God doesn't like him. So we're allowed to hate him. And those are the kind of things that the false prophet, the beast out of this earth, he will do that. It's deceit. It's a human worship of our own fleshly logic, our fleshly ideologies, our fleshly rationalizations, and our false wisdom that always guides us into doing things that will be very alien to God's will, but we convince ourselves, oh, this is very good for God. God likes this. And it's a very subtle thing that it does. So what we came to last couple chapters, just to catch up now, we saw in the last couple chapters, we saw the latest in the series of sevens. We had the seven seals and the seven trumpets, and now we had the seven bowls, which contained what? It's on the board. It's not. This isn't a trick. I'll get you soon, but this isn't a trick. Already got you once, right? So you.
The curveball.
That's right. There's the last seven plagues. Now, why are they the last seven plagues? The last one was ever see? It's all over? All done? Okay, that's the right answer, right?
No,
it was the completion of the picture that God makes on this earth. Remember, the seven seals did what for us?
Reveal.
The seal opens it real. It reveals something about the earth is crucial. Real human nature for what it is. The horrible side of human nature. The seven trumpets, what do trumpets do now?
Announce.
And what do they announce to us about the earth?
It's fragile.
It's fallible. It's going to fall apart. It's not going to be here all the time. So it's announcing you are going to live in this world and it will never last. So get used to it. Look at it. See it. Understand it. Look at you can't be here forever, no matter what. It's not going to last forever. And then the bowls of wrath are not an announcement or a revealing. It's actually an action on God's part. Because what did he do with those bowls of wrath? What did he do with them? Poured them out. He didn't just announce them or reveal them, he actually poured them out on the earth, his wrath, these plagues. Now, that sounds like a pretty vindictive thing of God to do, isn't it? That's the kind of thing that we always think about. Yeah, see, I told you right there. You tell me God loves us, look at what he's doing right there, pouring out these hideous plagues on us. Well, why was he doing that?
What was it? Judgment.
Well, it is judgment, but it's not a condemnatory judgment. A different form of judgment he is pouring out on us.
That's like a kindness to wake us up,
It is a kindness. It is a compassionate wrath, if you don't mind the phrase. Because why was that important? What did he do to make that important?
So that we would seek him.
So he's calling us to seek him, to lead us through the fire, to lead us across the glass sea. Something very crucial he had to do to bring us to him. He had to do something very important to change the earth when he came there. What did he do? What is it that causes wrath? What is it causes friction and fire when God does something? This is back from the book of Leviticus, so if you have any Levitical scholars in here. It's when God's holiness comes where? And specifically, uncleanness. That's what happens. When God's holiness comes into contact with uncleanness, what happens? It releases wrath. It's not a voluntary wrath that God releases, is it? He's not just saying, I don't like that guy, I'm going to release my wrath on him. And that guy, I guess I'll let him go. Because it's automatic. It's an automatic response from God that his wrath will be released when his holiness touches the unclean. So what does God have to do to call us to him? Where does he have to be?
Down here.
Down here, and specifically where? With who? With us, among us, in us. He has to do that. So when he calls us, when he comes to us, he has to have his holiness where? With us. And so if we're always going to be in this world, we all always have this tension between our uncleanness and God. So the things that we saw last week, he says, I'm going to have to pour out some wrath on your rivers, on your sea, on yourself, on your culture, your civilization, because you're going to be involved in that. From time to time, you'll experience that they will be a plague to you. They will strike at the things that you value. Yourself is a blessing or a curse.
Both.
Yeah. Well, you can qualify. Okay, if you answer either one, you're right, because it's both. Because who you are, who God gave you, is yourself. It is a blessing if you use yourself to do what? To give it to him. If you use it for your selfishness, what'll it do? It'll release God's wrath on you when you make yourself unclean, because that's what'll do it. So everything in the world will always contain blessings and curses. And that is where?
Deuteronomy.
In what chapter?
28.
Oh, very good. That's Deuteronomy chapter 8. 28. You see, he says, I'm going to give you baskets and kneading dishes, kneading troughs, and if you stay close to me, they will be blessings. If you walk away from me, they will be curses. The same thing. So that's the thing that he said. When we look at God striking us, that's not striking us out of vindiction. It's not striking a hateful wrath. It's a compassionate wrath. He has to be close to us, but there's always that tension. That is the fire that we have to go through in this life. When we get too close to something unclean, his wrath will flare out a little bit. Not to strike us, not even to punish us physically. We'll just feel that tension. Hey, I've come into contact something with unclean here. I need to deal with this. I need to see what it's saying to me. This thing that I'm doing, I realize a tension. I have to come back to God, get back closer to God when that happens. Okay, now, that's the quick recap of those things. Well, now we're going to see a new beast today. We have a scarlet beast. And this has two partners in it we're going to read about. We're going to read first this woman of mystery, then we're going to look at her pet beast, and then we're going to see the mutual resentment that they have for each other. So, Lloyd, can you read read the first six verses of Revelation 17, and then read the last verse of the chapter, verse 18, just to help us to figure out what she is.
One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adultery. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names, and had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, and was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adultery. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes, and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. The woman you saw is a great city that rules over the kings of the earth.
Okay, so that's pretty self-explanatory. So do you want to explain that, right? We can move on. Well, let me ask you to think about a couple of things here. You see this picture. There's this bright red, blazing red beast who is strange looking, and then there's this finely dressed woman who is glittering with gems and beautiful cloths and everything. She's having a good time riding this beast. What images would this put in your mind? What do you think is going on? What kind of places would they help you think of? What kind of images come to mind with that?
Vegas.
That's what it is. That's right. It sounds like it could be in Las Vegas, right?
In Vegas.
Could be in Las Vegas. What else could it be? Hollywood, someone said. A circus? Big circus? Big excitement and thrills? And that's what it is showing us. This is, what are people doing here? They're having all kind of fun, all kind of pleasure, letting themselves loose. This is the image that we're seeing now. This is the image of the world's being filled with seeming promise of fun and thrills for evermore in your life. The people that look at the world as a big circus or a big adult toy store that's full of all kind of things that will always make you have a great time. Now, we'll go back and look over some of these things, if you keep that in mind. The first thing it says that this woman, she sits by many waters. That's actually a quote from Jeremiah in 51. The city that sits by the big waters is one of the famous cities in history. But good guess, because that's what she's called. She's called Babylon, so that's probably what it is. Now, this is the city she's compared to that is sitting by several waters. But is this mean that she is literally the city of Babylon?
No.
And how do we know that if we know a little bit of history? How do we know this is not it?
It was already gone.
It was already long gone. Already gone for hundreds of years. Just ruins by this time. So it's not Babylon. But what else could Babylon mean if that image is used? And give you another little... That could be part of it, sure. That could be part of it.
Oh, I'm just thinking ourselves.
In a sense, a place to indulge yourself. A place to just indulge all your whims and wishes, just everything you can have. Babylon, at the time, it was a great city on earth. What did they do in Babylon?
Indulge
themselves. That's what he did. Look, read back in Daniel chapter 5 sometime when you see that picture of the big banquet that their last king, Belshazzar, had on the night they were taken over. Read all this stuff they did. They're just having a great time. Every kind of sinfulness, self-indulgence, and all the things they could do because they were sitting there thinking, what were they thinking that they could get away with that?
Well, they had all their power. They thought they were
invincible. All power in the world, right? We're indefensible. We're impregnable. And also, we've been doing this for a long time now. So what does that mean?
Nobody can bring us down.
I can keep doing it forever, right? I've been getting away with this stuff all of my life, so I can keep going with it, can't I? And that's the thing that you see. Babylon is the image for indulgence. And of course, in the time of this, you could think of another famous city at the time. You could say, well, they maybe that's that other city too.
Rome,
sure. And so there's actually a subtle reference to it that connects Rome and Babylon together. Now, the thing that we see when we look at this woman, the rider, what does the rider's appearance look like? Forget about the scarlet beast for a minute, but what do you see about the woman? Verse 4, what do you see?
She's dressed really nice.
Yeah, she's got all these purple cloth, the most expensive cloth, and red to symbolize the excitement and revelry of being the woman in red. That's what it's about. And she has, yeah, she's got, that's the other thing. She's glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls. And what then does she hold in her hand?
A cup of beverage.
Golden cup, and what does it have, this really sweet, delicious beverage in it? What's it filled with?
Abominable
things and the filth of her adulteries. So this is a contrast. She is really concealing what's inside her. Now we see that it says that the beast is even covered with blasphemous names. And it says, you notice what it accuses her specifically. It accuses her one specific sin, it says over and over again. Adultery. But what does that mean? Does that mean literal adultery, or does it mean something different?
You mean doing, you know, doing anything?
Yeah, adultery to whom? To God. Adultery to God. See, adultery to God is not a special sin. It's just a sin. It's a sin like greed or hatred or violence. They're all the same to God. They're not special. But this version of adultery, that takes on a very dangerous calling. When you are being adulterous to God, when you're straying from God, you don't want to be with God because you see something fun out there. That's where you're after. And this is the kind of thing that he's talking about. That's what adultery is always used in these passages, always being adulterous to God. You're not satisfied with God, so you want something else. You want the things of the world. You want to enjoy yourself, collect things, accomplish things, just have the pleasure of it. That's the thing that he's talking about. Spiritual adultery is the problem here.
You think something else is more important than God, because you're following other gods, right?
Yeah, something that... That's right.
That you think, oh, that glitter's over there much better than God.
That's right. That's exactly what it is. You're thinking, you know, my life is not fulfilled because there's more fun I can have. Who did that in the Old Testament? Who had the best relationship with God that you could imagine and blew it?
Solomon,
right? Read the book of Ecclesiastes. Yeah, I got a great relation with God. I think I'll build myself a new palace. That'll make me feel even better. I got a relationship with God. I think I can have a lot of slaves and women and have a lot of fun with the women. That I'll feel even better. I can push people around, boss them around, make them do what I say. That'll make you feel better. And how did it keep making feeling?
Worse and worse.
Let's take a look at the folly of adultery and idolatry. Look back at Isaiah 44. Jenny, could you read this for us? Isaiah 44, verses 14 to 20. This is how idols are created, back in Isaiah 44. This is a little instruction manual from God. How do you create an idol?
He cut down cedar, or perhaps a cypress or oak, let it grow among the trees of the forest, or planted a pine, and the rain made it grow. It is man's food for burning. Some of it he takes and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes flour, but he also fashions a god and worships it. He makes an idol and bows down to it. Half of the wood he burns in the fire, over it he prepares his meal. He roasts his meat and eats his fill. He also warms himself and says, ah, I'm warm, I see the fire. From the rest he makes a god, his idol. He bows down to it and worships. He prays to it and says, save me, you are my god. They know nothing, they understand nothing. Their eyes are plastered over so they cannot see, and their minds closed so they cannot understand. No one stops to think. No one has the knowledge or the understanding to say, half of it I use for fuel. I even baked bread over its coals. I roasted meat and I ate. Shall I make a detestable thing from what is left? Shall I bow down to a block of wood? He feeds on ashes, but the weary heart misleads him. He cannot save himself or say, is not this thing, my right hand, a lie?
This describes how idols come into being. Where did this idol come from? This is a pop out of the nowhere? Where did it come from? He made it. He created it with his own hands. And what is he worshiping?
What he created.
The thing he worshiping is health, because he created. Look at this great idol. There are several other passages in Isaiah that are quite funny too. I've put them in your notes. You can look them up sometime. But this is how idols come into being. He says he doesn't even think, you know, this stuff, I burned half of it to make my food, and then I make an idol out of the other half, and so we're going to worship the thing. Now, what will you think of somebody like that? Would you be filled with anger and rage and indignation at them, or will you feel something else toward them? What a fool. How silly is this guy? But then, what do we do when we create our idols? When you pick some person and idolize this person, this athlete or entertainer or actor or some politician, and you build him up into your idol, where did that come from?
Same thing.
You created him in your mind because you said, these are the things I want, and this guy's going to get them for me. I want to be like him. And you're creating it just not of a wood or a metal, but you're creating it out of your dreams and your desires, which are every bit as foolish to worship as the things of the world. we worship money, material things. Those are just silly little things made out of the same junk as the rest of the things in the world. We worship our accomplishments. We say, I'm going to accomplish it. I'm going to prove that I can do this. I'm going to prove I have what it takes to do this. And where did that come from? You said in your mind, I'm going to do this thing because it's going to make me great. You just decided it's going to make you great. It's an arbitrary decision. And then you fulfill it, and you're doing the same thing that this guy is doing. And it will suck your life out of you if you do that. Quick.
I think it's interesting that it's wood that he prepares the idol from. The wood, it's a good thing if used properly. He uses it to bake his bread and to eat. But so it's like we take good things and then turn them. You know, it's, you know, like money. Money can be a good thing, but in the wrong motivation, it can be bad. So it's not that it's necessarily just something straight evil.
That's right. And that's an illustration of what, if you start worshiping the things that were meant to be good to you, what will that release?
Wrath,
right? Will release God's wrath because you're turning into something unclean. It was a perfectly acceptable thing, but when you worship it, you make it unclean, and it'll strike your heart. Not strike it down. It'll sap the life out of your heart. You may still feel good about it. You may feel great about it because you're going to take away your sensitivity to God. It will take away your sense of God, your need for God, your sense of your need for God. Good.
We're looked to the cross, not to the wood idol we made. We're worshiping Jesus. And he's only just the opposite of that.
He's the only thing that can really do anything for us. Because that's what we say when you worship your idols. This is going to do something for me. It's going to make me feel good. It's going to make me feel great. And it will always make you feel that way for a short time. And this, all this glitter and attraction on the woman, it gives her this aura of mystery. And in some version of the Bible, he even says that there's a big sign in her. Mystery, mystery, here I am. Because it looks enticing, looks intriguing. What's this world about? That looks like fun. I'm going to go do it. Oh, I could do this. I can do this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to experience it. And it sounds so intriguing and mysterious. But we always think we can go and battle on the world in its own terms. And you know what will happen to you if you do that? Either one or two things will happen. Either it'll crush your spirit or it'll make you feel great. And then you're really dead. Because God loves you, and you start playing. If you go playing around with the world and do foolish things that you shouldn't be doing, or spending too much time away from God, and it does crush you and make you feel terrible, that is a blessing for God. That is a very compassionate blessing for God when He makes you feel terrible. But if you start getting away with doing it and still feel great, that is much, much, much worse. That is when you have really wandered into dangerous spiritual territory. Because the danger of these things, Doctor, you look at the scripture in 1 John 2 for us, 15-17. The real danger of playing with these things, it's not that God's going to smack you around and take your life away. The worst thing is, He realized you're just going into that, so I'm going to let you enjoy it. That's fine. That's fine. I don't want to force myself on you. That's the worst thing He can do to you, when He leaves you alone and lets you enjoy it. The more torment He puts in your heart when you're playing with the wrong things, He's going to keep you coming back to Him. But when He makes you feel, this is great, then you're on the wrong road. 1 John 2:15-17.
Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. But everything in the world, the cravings of sinful men, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and he does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever.
So you have a choice between the things that will pass away, that will lead you to death, or you have the choice of leading to things that will give you life forever. And those things come from God. That wasn't a trick. That comes from God. You have to learn to look at the things from God, the people that God's put in your life to lead you back to God, the people who will encourage you to do the right things, the things that remind you of God, the things in the scriptures that teach you. Those are the things that you have to seek. Because it's not just only relying on God alone, because we can also pretend that we're going to rely on God alone. He's going to take care of me, whatever silly thing I do. Because you have to look at the people in their life will tell you one way or another what to do. They'll tell you the good things, and they might tell you to bad things. That's what we have to seek God's wisdom and God's scriptures to teach us these things. Because there are always going to be people leading off someplace, aren't they? Look, hey, it's fun. Look, I'm doing this. It's great. It'll make you feel great. But come along with me. What are you going to do? You have to think about it, don't you? You have to seek God's guidance for you. The thing that you see at the end of this, the woman is drunk with what?
Blood of saints.
What is the blood that she has been drinking? What she's been drinking from them?
The golden cup.
Their life. She's drinking the life out of them. She's draining the life out of their heart. She's draining it out of them. Why is she even draining it from the saints? Because we're still sheep, aren't we? We're still sheep. We can let off in one silly thing or another. Be the excitement of something that is going to give us pleasure, the excitement of something that will make us feel powerful or strong or good about ourselves. Always those temptations will ever be there for us. This woman gets away with it a lot. So we have to understand her. So that's what he say when we pick up in the next passage, we'll see that. Well, but first of all, what city is she? Is she Babylon or Rome or New York or Hollywood or Las Vegas?
Is where we live now.
That's a trick question. It's it's the world's pleasure dome, if you remember the old Coleridge poem. It's the world's pleasure dome. That's what it's here for, just to have a good time and get away with it. Never have to feel bad about it. And the things that God makes you feel bad about are different than things that we think are guilt. See, you're not going to get guilt from God. God is, if you feel guilty about something, that is probably Satan accusing him of you. What the kind of feeling that you get when you stray from God is this nagging feeling, I don't feel this is leading me to God. I need something. I'm missing something. I'm not getting something. I'm not close to myself. I don't see what I'm doing. I'm not close to God. I don't understand what this is doing for me. I think this is futile. That's the thing that God will put in your hearts. Because you have to have the peace of God. You need the things of God. You will need the things that God can give you to show you where you are. And so many people will live their whole life wandering around, even if find what they're all about, even trying to find their true self. Because your true self is what we said that God puts the plagues on. Yourself is given to you for only one thing, which is let it nailed be the cross with Jesus. And that's what you get if you have this senseless craving and craving for more and more. You're not yourself. You have to find the self that God put in you. It's a saying, if you will bear a couple Simone Weil quotes. She said that worldly beauty always promises but never gives anything. The world glittering prizes always looks like it'll be fun, exciting, makes you feel great, but they never really give you anything. She said something else different too, is the first decision that we have to make is not to believe in God. All we can start it with is decide not to give our love to false gods. Because the false gods are always going to be there imposing themselves in your face. You're going to have to deal with them first. Clean them out. Because God will have to let you empty yourself of yourself in your desires to see Him. Now, we have to move on here. If we look over to Revelation 17, pick up here in verse 7. Perry, could you read 7 to 14 for us?
Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and the beast she rides, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast which you saw once was... now it is not, and yet will come up out of the abyss and go to destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have been written in the book of life for the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because it once was, now is not, and yet will come. This calls for a mind with wisdom. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. There are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come, but when he does come, he must remain for only a little while. The beast who once was and now is not is an ape. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers.
So this paints us a different picture of explaining the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has seven heads and ten horns. Now, what beast does that remind you of that you saw for earlier? What other beast had all kind of horns and heads? The one that came out of the sea. So why would her little scarlet pet, what would her scarlet pet resemble a beast of the sea? What does she need to support her position as the great purveyor of pleasures and toys to everybody? What does she take to depend on that? What is she riding on?
The power and force.
Yeah. The power of self-will and force. She has to cater to that. She always has to cater to that, you can do anything you want. That beast has to convince you first before you're attracted to her. That beast first has to convince you, you can have anything you want, you can do anything you want, all cool. That's what he does. And that's what will lead you then to be enticed, this mysterious woman, because she will then have the power over you that she wants. The thing that she has going with her is something else we saw back in Revelation 13. So she was, once was, now is not, yet will come. Remember Revelation 13:3, it described this about the beast from the sea. What happened to one of his horns? A fatal wound. Right, exactly. Had a fatal wound. But what happened to the fatal wound?
Healed.
Because all these idols that we pursue, when someone knocks one of them down and proves that it was silly and can't get anywhere, and it's been convincingly refuted to us, that idol doesn't work. What do? We say, okay, I'll come back to God. Or do we find another one?
Find another one,
because it'll all come back. A horn dies, that's okay. I got a new horn. We'll just tack it on here. Look, it looks good, doesn't it? That's what it does. You're always going to give another excuse to wander off in your spiritual adultery. So what do you have to do? What does it say in the first of verse 7? What does it say we have to do? What does it say?
Understand.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Verse 9, I'm sorry. What does it call for in verse 9? Got to have a little wisdom here. You're going to see these same idols falling and falling. So, at some point, you got to figure this thing out. You just got to get it here sometime. And God will put those things in our life over and over again. He is so gentle with you people. He is so gentle with you. He will show you over and over. You're going to do this, it's going to frustrate you. You're going to feel unfulfilled. You're going to feel distant from me. You're not going to get it. You're going to feel like you're going nowhere here. He does that with you so many times. But we keep resisting. No, I think I can keep going here. I think I get a little bit more in it. I don't have quite enough money. Just a little more money and I'll fare great. You're wrong, God. I need a little bit more money and I'll get great. I need a new toy. I'm great except for the new car. Once I get a new car, I'll fare great. That's what we do. Think over and over and over again. I just need to have a little bit better job. Then I'll feel good about myself. All these silly things, it's all the same thing that we do to ourselves. That's the same, the horn dying, the scarlet beast, he's gone. Oh, there he is again. Because we'll always find a new pet. And what he's saying is to help us to realize what's going on. And the thing with the seven heads and seven hills and ten horns, this is the kind of thing that commentators will wander into making commentary and commentary. What's this king and that country and that? What is this really saying? If you just summarize it. Everybody's fighting everybody. That's all it is. Some kings fall, some kings come up, some kings rule for an hour. Their time is always short. That's all it is. It is back in Matthew 24, if you read, Jesus says, "For many come and I'm maimed, claiming I'm Messiah, and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains." When you read about these wars and someone latches them up with this king and that horn and all this new excitement, what is it? What does Jesus say it is? Birth pains. All the stuff is this birth pains. That's all it is. All the turmoil of the world, it's just birth pains. Because how are we being born? How are we being born that can be very painful? Spiritual rebirth. That's all about regenerating your heart, regenerating your spirit. Because God has to do things to us that will be very painful as long as we resist them. If we don't resist them, it'll feel pretty good. Because to release yourself, to empty yourself of self, actually will be a feeling of freedom. Because you're no longer chained to the world and expectations of you. It will free you from yourself. And you will truly become yourself. If you let God empty you of yourself, you will become like your true self, because he'll stop filling you with somebody that is your true self, is Jesus. But you have to clear those spaces out of your heart first if you want to really truly see who you really are. Now, he's doing war against the Lamb here. We saw waging war against the Lamb. They're waging war. So that means we got to get some swords and guns and fight them back, right? Let's go for it. Let's fight them back. Let's argue with them, hate them. Well, we'll get our, or rah-rah, go out and fight these guys, right? No. What kind of fighting does he do against the Lamb and the Lamb's followers? What does he do to them? Where is he fighting them?
It's not against flesh and blood.
Nothing to do with flesh and blood. Nothing to do with flesh and blood. Where is he fighting them? He keeps trying to convince their hearts, you can do it my way, and it'll be good. And God keeps gently telling us, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. Don't do it. You'll regret it. God is so gentle. But they're pretty aggressive. They're pretty hostile. So what should our response to this be? Well, I think you've picked this off the menu if you want to look at Psalm 46, verse 10 and 11. You can read that for us in a minute. This is the only response we can have to all these assaults of the world and its pleasures and its idols and its temptations.
Be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord Almighty is with us. The God of Jacob is our fortress.
Who's the fortress that we have? Is God. And because we have God, when we see all this turmoil going around us, what can we do?
Be still
and know that He is God. He's going to take care of us. We're not going to have to go out and have to fight people physically. But where do we have to find our strength? We have to keep coming back to have to be with God. If we don't really truly with God, not just look to God to help us, but actually be with God. There's a huge difference between, I'll let God help me. That's not what he's saying. You have to be with God. Be with God. That's what it's saying. That's where you get the true strength, and it's where you get the truest spiritual peace. You should find out who you really were meant to be. That's a real self that God created in you. That's who God created you to be. Go ahead, Warren.
Well, John gave us the life of his, and we might live for him, not for Satan. But he's helping us give our hearts to Jesus and to God.
That's very true. Because God didn't create us to serve ourselves, and he didn't create us just to go running around doing things for him. He just created us to be with him, because that was always his intention, was to have us to be with him. Now, I have to abridge the last section here. This last section, you see that the beast and the rider, they turn on each other. They start fighting each other. They're tearing each other's flesh apart. Because this is the uncontrollable impulse to dominate. As the old Nietzschean saying, we always want the will to power. We always want to have this craving to control each other. So the beast and her rider, they tear on each other. It's always evident that in this world, in this self-celebratory world, in the pleasure dome, they're always competing with each other. They're always fighting each other. They're never happy with what they have. When you have enough toys, you think that why are you not getting enough? Because somebody has them. I need to take them away from them. We always have to battle and struggle. We're fighting them and we're fighting ourselves. I'll let you take a look and look at the notes. Because it's a never-ending cycle that this craving of pleasure and accomplishment and excitement will always lead you in a never-ending cycle where you're always going to be plagued with all the things that are not part of who you're meant to be. You'll be plagued with feelings of envy and jealousy and rivalry. You'll even be plagued with the wrong kind of guilt, which is not the kind of guilt that God wants you to have. And so these are things that always all come along with that. But what I want to read for you to finish is Psalm 73. Tells us about wakening from a dream. The thing that we can realize because we are so prone to think that we're missing out. That's a phrase that we so often hear. You're missing out. You ever hear people say that? Even people in the church will say that because they're trying to advertise things to you when not really helping you to be with God. Always trying to advertise the things we're doing. You're missing out. No, you're not missing out if you are with God. You're not missing out at anything if you're with God. You're not missing anything. Well, the world does the same thing. You're missing out. It's great. It's fun. Well, read this first part of this, Psalm 73. I haven't forgotten the trivia. We'll get there. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost slipped. I had nearly lost my foothold. For I envy the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They are free from common human burdens. They are not plagued by human ills. What does it look like out there in the pleasure dome? They're having fun. I'm behaving and I'm not having fun. I feel bad. I feel terrible. They're having fun. Nothing's bothering them. That is because we have the wrong things that we desire in our hearts. And so this is the self-inflicting pain that it brings when you think they are not having fun. They may be having fun in their flesh, but the more fun they have in their flesh, what's happening in their heart? They're losing out their life. They're losing out the true joys. Because when you get to the point when you can really get excited about doing something in the world, you've died. When you can really get excited about having something in the world, you just died. Because you will always miss out on the real pleasures. If you can't really say to yourself that I can get true joy of being with God, true peace with being with God, because I'm more excited about something else, that's the path of death. Economics trivia question. We're going to come back to Psalm 73. Economics trivia. What is the smallest denomination of money that has ever been printed on United States paper currency? Paper currency. What was the lowest denomination that's ever been printed on paper currency? Well, is it $1? Maybe that's the smallest. There's never been anything less than a dollar. Well, it's 50 cents or half a dollar. 25 cents, quarter dollar. Maybe 20 cents. Maybe with 3 cents. Sounds weird, doesn't it?
3 cents of that.
This comes from the 1860s and 1870s. At the end of the Civil War, people had seen that during the war, metals became so valuable that after the war, people didn't want to spend their coins. These are going to become valuable someday. And in fact, that was the case. If you took a penny printed in 1867 and put it in your pocket, waited for 100 years, it would be worth a dollar. So that was a great plan. But that's what they get. And then it's mainly all across the country, people didn't want to spend their coins because at the time, the quarters and half dollars were made of silver. They didn't want to spend it. It's going to be valuable someday. And if they kept it in the pocket, wait 100 years, it would have been worth something. But so the government kind of says, we'll meet you halfway. We'll print some 50 cents bills, 50 cents currency. There you go. Well, that didn't quite work. So, okay, 25-cent currency. We'll pass that around. Then the 20 cents, they put some currency. They even made 20-cent coins. Will that work? Give one of these away, not a quarter? Didn't work. They printed off only 20-cent coins. People hoarded them. And they didn't even spend the coins made out of silver. Even back then, they had nickels made of nickel and pennies made out of copper, just cheap old copper. They didn't want to spend them. They weren't spending them. So they had to print a 3 cents bill. Yeah, it's 3 cents bill. United States of America, 3 cents. That's what it was. Because it got so ridiculous that people wanted to hoard all their money. Because it just shows what it builds on you, the false anticipation. I'm going to keep all my pennies. Someday we'll work a lot. Well, they never were. Do you know how they finally stopped that? In the 1870s, they told stores that they didn't have to accept money at face value. So stores put it on a sign. Your coins will be accepted at full value. Paper money will be accepted 50% of the face value. That stopped it. That's the only way they did it. It's a gradual debasing of things that we put value. Money is only useful for what? What you can get with it. That's all it ever means. This has new use in itself. If you have money that God gives us more than enough money to buy the things that we actually need, that's all it is ever for. If you start taking pride in having more money than you need, that's danger. You're leading down the path to spiritual death. You have enough, that should be enough. If you have too much, give some of it away. That's the only thing we can do. Now, that's the thing that he's telling us about in this psalm. When you look back at what he's doing, Psalm 73, picking up in verse 13. Surely in vain I have kept my heart pure and have washed my hands in innocence. All day long I have been afflicted, and every morning brings new punishments. I'm doing the right thing, and here I am. I'm just not getting all this fun. I'm not having fun. I'm not doing the things. I'm not piling up stuff like everyone else is. Well, verse 16, when I tried to understand all this, it troubled me deeply till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. Where did he enter? Did he go to the temple? No, that's not the sanctuary he was at. Where's the sanctuary of God? With God. He pulled himself away, all this turmoil in the world, sat down with God, and asked him, I would like to understand this, God, because it really troubles me. And he opened his ears, opened his eyes. And it says, surely you place them on slippery ground. You cast them down to ruin. How suddenly are they destroyed, completely swept away with terror. They are like a dream when one awakes. When you arise, Lord, you will despise them in fantasies. All these things that people put so much hope in, put so much pleasure in, the day is going to come when they will all disappear like a mist. Yanked away from him. No warning, no preparation, all will be gone. And how will that put them? Verse 21, when my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was a brute beast before you. Yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. Afterward you will take me into glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And earth has nothing I desire besides you. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. It's okay if your flesh fails. It's okay if your heart fails. It's okay if your flesh suffers. It's okay, because God is the strength of your heart and your portion forever. That's your true destiny, your true inheritance is God, to be your portion forever. Those who are far from you will perish. You destroy all who are unfaithful to you. But as for me, it is good to be where? Near God. I have made the sovereign Lord my refuge. I will tell of all your deeds. He's not going to go and telling people all the deeds God has done to pile up wealth for him or have fun. He's going to tell everyone, this is what God's done for me. He kept me going in this world. He kept me going through all this that disappointed me, hurt. He kept me going. He saved me. He redeemed me from my sins. He forgave my folly. He forgave my own rebellion against him. That's what God has done. Those are the deeds that I will praise, because that is God's glory. And he let go. We ran over, so I will see you next time.